Hello and welcome to the second episode of a podcast that I'm calling Tales from the Battlefields. My name is Terry Wenham and I've been an amateur historian and researcher for over 20 years now. I was inspired to start researching soldiers that fought and died in World War One by my great uncle Henry, who died on the Somme in 1916, and my grandfather Arthur, who won the Distinguished Conduct Medal at Ober's Ridge in 1915. And now I'm a volunteer for the Commonwealth War Graves Commission, and I'm also a volunteer fundraiser for the Army Benevolent Funds, the ABF, the Soldiers' Charity, as it's now called. And just quickly, while we're talking about the Soldiers' Charity, every year, apart from one because of COVID, we've been walking 75 miles across the battlefields of World War One and also World War Two to raise money for this wonderful charity. The charity's there for soldiers, former soldiers and their families for life. And if you want to know more about the charity, you can go on to the website, which is soldierscharity.org. And on there, you'll find details of this year's frontline walk, which will be going across the Western Front battlefields and also the Normandy battlefields in October of this year. And there are still some places on there. So if you want to come and join us and be involved in something that you'll never, ever forget, then this is the time to do it, really. It's a great way of meeting people, learning about the battlefields, raising some money for this charity, and meeting people from all sorts of, all walks of life, really. A lot of them veterans that have served in, perhaps in the Falklands or in Iraq. A lot of people, like myself, that are civilians. And we all rub along together. We have a great time. And as I say, we raise a lot of money for the charity. Since we started doing the Frontline Walk, which was in 2014, we've raised something like £1.5 million for the charity. So it's something that's very, very close to my heart. Now, before I go any further with this second podcast in the series, I just wanted to say something about what's going on in Ukraine. I don't know anything about the politics or the military behind it. All I know is that all the time I've been visiting the battlefields of World War One and World War Two, I've always drawn strength not just from the accounts and the stories that we discover from the soldiers that fought in World War One and World War Two, but we also appreciate the fact that it's not happening now. It was always history. And in the 57 years that I've been on this earth, apart from the Falklands War, we've lived in peace. It hasn't affected us in Europe. We haven't had, of course, Falklands wasn't in Europe anyway. It was a long way away. We haven't had a war on our doorstep. We certainly haven't had countries in Europe invading other countries. But of course, it's not history. It's actually happening now. And when I turn on the news, I've got the news on the TV in front of me now, it looks more like a scene from the 1940s, the German invasion of Europe. And it's incredible to think that this is really happening now. There's nothing we can do about it. There's nothing I can do about it. It really is beyond belief. But I just wanted to make a passing reference to that, as this podcast is all about war and suffering of people. The last fighting Tommy from the First World War is a guy called Harry Patch. Harry lived to be the grand old age of 111, and he was the last man that can tell us what it was like to fight on the battlefields of World War One. And during his final trip to the battlefields, I think it was in about a year or so before he died, he was asked by the historian Richard Van Endem about how he would like not just his memory, but also the memory of the soldiers from his generation that fought in the Great War. What would be their lasting memorial? And it was Harry's response that always stuck in my mind. And this is what he said. "The best memorial for the likes of me would be to look after the soldiers who are still fighting for their country now, and equally important, their families." And it was those words by Harry that inspired me to join the Army Benevolent Fund, ABF, the Soldiers Charity, and get involved in fundraising to help the soldiers and veterans of today. For me, it would mean that when I finished researching and guiding people around the World War One battlefields, hopefully there would be a lasting legacy for my efforts that would actually raise some money to help these guys that have fought now. And hopefully that's what we've achieved over the last 7 or 8 years, and that fundraising will continue. And what I'm also hoping is that by talking about the ABF during this podcast, that other people will be inspired to come along and help us and get involved with the charity. I won't say anything else at this stage about the charity. We're going to have an entire podcast at some stage where we're going to discuss the charity in more detail. We're going to look at the work of some of the beneficiaries and the ambassadors that work for the charity. And we're also going to focus on the Frontline Walk and talk about some of the extraordinary stories that have come out of that. But now, today's podcast. And for people that listened to last week's podcast, thank you very much. And it's been great to get some feedback from people as well. And it seems that quite a lot of people have enjoyed it, which has encouraged me now to go on and do this second one. The idea of the podcast for people that tuned in last week was to tell the untold or the unheard stories of the soldiers that I've researched over the last 20 years. You won't find the stories that I'm about to tell you in any of the history books. As far as I know, none of them have been published other than in local newspapers, but they do need to be told. Absolutely incredible stories. So who are these soldiers that I want to talk about this week? Well, they're all brothers, which is why I've called the title of this podcast Brothers in Arms. Last week I talked about my great uncle Henry and his brother Arthur, who was to become my grandfather, and that inspired me over the years to look at the stories of brothers that went off, maybe together in some cases, to fight in the Great War, and what happened to them. When you walk around cemeteries, you quite often see brothers buried together. I can think of there's a cemetery in Ypres, the Ypres Reservoir Cemetery, where there's two brothers that are buried together there. I think they're called Knott. One died on the Ypres salient, and the other one died on the Somme. But their father arranged for the one that was on the Somme to be taken to Ypres so he could be buried and lay forever next to his brother. And it's stories like that that made me interested in researching siblings and brothers that had fought. Some survived, but many of them killed together or separately, and the stories that lay behind them. So let's get cracking. Let's have a look at some of these stories. The first one that I wanted to talk about came from a newspaper article in the Northampton Chronicle and Echo. I was just browsing through the newspaper recently, and I noticed a heading that said Brothers win DCM. DCM stands for the Distinguished Conduct Medal, and it's just one step down from the Victoria Cross. And this is what the newspaper article said. The proud distinction of having two sons win the DCM belongs to Mr. and Mrs. T.A. Cotton of 1 Castle Street, Northampton. Private T.A. Cotton, Northamptonshire Regiment, was awarded the medal for carrying a machine gun under heavy fire. He has been at the front since the commencement of operations and has been twice wounded, the second time being the occasion of his gallant action. Private W.H. Cotton has also been wounded twice and gained the honour for dispatch, carrying and helping the wounded. So I was immediately attracted to this. I had to find out more about these Cotton brothers. What happened to them? Did they survive the war? Because the newspaper article was printed in November 1916, halfway through the war. Did these guys come back home? And the answer is, one did and one didn't. So let's start with the first one. William, or as the newspaper calls him, W.H. Cotton. And he was originally, at the start of the war, joined up with his local regiment, the Northamptonshires. And then in January 1917, he became part of the Tank Corps, the newly established Tank Corps that had started off. Their first battle had taken place just a few months before, during the Battle of the Somme. And on the 8th of August 1918, the Allies launched their final 100-day offensive against the German army. And this first day of that offensive was to be known as the Battle of Amiens. And young William was involved with his unit in a tank, and they attacked near the village called Villers-Bretonneux. The attack that day was a tremendous success. The Allies, together, fighting together on land and in the air, captured thousands of German prisoners, killed many more Germans, and also captured many machine guns and heavy guns and light guns that the German army had amassed. Finally, after 4 years of trench warfare, the tide had turned and the war was now into the open. The Germans were forever in retreat until November the 11th, 1918, when the armistice was signed. Casualties were very heavy during that period because they no longer had the trenches to protect them because this was now open warfare. But what happened on that day to our man, William, in his tank? Well, he was one of the British casualties that day. He was hit by a shell, or his tank was hit by a shell, and it struck him in the left thigh. Now, he survived. He wasn't killed, and he was evacuated from the battlefield. And by this time, of course, in the war, the British process of evacuation of the wounded was brilliant. Before you know it, he was into a casualty clearing station, and they did attempt to operate, but the records show that he was dangerously ill, and an operation on his wounded left leg was going to be too dangerous. He might have died. They discovered that not only did he have a shell wound, but it was a gas shell, and he was suffering from gas gangrene. Gangrene had actually infected the wound, which is why he was so seriously ill. But he was evacuated back to the UK, and he was taken to a military hospital in Denmark Hill in London. And exactly a month after being wounded, he was operated on. Unfortunately, because of the gas gangrene, his leg couldn't be saved and his leg was amputated. And of course, that was the end of his war service. He was discharged from the army in 1919. He was in hospital for several months, but he lived. He lived, and he lived until he was 76 years old, finally dying on the 6th of October, 1972. So William lived for over half a century, 54 years, I make it, with just one leg. But I wonder, and I hope, and I'm sure he did, realise that he took part in one of the most successful days for the British Army and our allies in the Great War. And it was a day that finally broke the back of the German army. It was still going to take a long time, 100 days, 3 months, before the armistice came along. But Ludendorff, General Ludendorff, the German commander, he realised on that day the game was up. And he declared that the 8th of August 1918 was the blackest day of the German army. So what of William's brother, Thomas A. Cotton, who was in the 2nd Battalion of the Manchester Regiment? Now, Thomas was one of those volunteers that enlisted right at the beginning of the war. He was one of Kitchener's army, one of the first volunteers, and he'd gone right through 4 years of the war without any major injury. As we know from the newspaper article, he'd been wounded a couple of times and awarded the Distinguished Conduct Medal, the DCM, for his efforts, like his brother. But after a search on the Commonwealth War Graves Commission website, I found an entry of death for Thomas, and it was dated the 24th of July 1920, some, 18 months after the armistice in November of 1918. And that's not unusual. The cut-off date for the commission for deaths from World War I is the 31st of August 1921. So between November 1918 and August 1921, you'll find thousands of soldiers on the Commonwealth War Graves Commission website that died during that period. And most of them, of course, would have died of their wounds, or they'd have died of flu because of the flu pandemic that was running rife through Europe in 1918 and 1919. So I wasn't surprised to find a date of death. But the next piece of information on the entry on the website did confuse me, because it said that he had no known grave, that he'd been killed in action on the 24th of July 1920, and that he was remembered on the Basra Memorial in what is now called Iraq, but was then called Mesopotamia. How could that be? How could he have been killed in action in 1920? There hadn't been any fighting since November 1918, not as far as I knew anyway. I knew nothing about anything, any fighting that was going on in 1920. There had to be an explanation, and there was. In the 1920s, in Iraq and other places in the Middle East, it was a very dangerous and unsettled place to be. There was a series of incidents that took place in the summer of 1920, which ended in a revolt in Iraq, and increasing civil disobedience took hold. And there was one particular incident where a railway station south of Baghdad was attacked, and the local political officer asked for assistance from the British Army garrison that was based not far away. So on the 23rd of July 1920, a military force was sent south to assist, and part of that was the 2nd Manchester's, which our Thomas was part of. And on the 24th of July, the next day, they arrived at 12:35, and they were absolutely exhausted because of the extreme heat, and the medical officer recommended that they rested for 24 hours. But it was whilst they were resting that their camp was struck. There was a force of at least 3,000 insurgents that approached the camp. They got within 150 yards from the camp and fire was exchanged. The decision to withdraw was then taken, but it was dark by this time and the men became disorientated in this darkness. Some of the Manchesters and other parts of the column became completely lost and they fell into the hands of the insurgents. Some of them were killed immediately, but the majority of them were actually taken prisoner. But they were being taken prisoners by savages, not by the Germans that we'd got to know on the Western Front. There were conflicting reports of the numbers of casualties, but it's thought that 20 were killed. This was the original report. 20 killed, 60 wounded, and 318 of them were missing, presumed captured or dead. And of the 318 that were missing, 160 were released at various times by their captors. But that meant that 134 were finally recorded by the Commonwealth War Graves Commission as being killed either on that day or in the days that followed. And the reports that I've read said that the prisoners from the Manchester Regiment were tortured and then executed by their captors. An absolutely horrendous story. So back home in Northampton, it was Thomas and William's proud parents that wrote to the local newspaper announcing the fact that both sons had been awarded the DCM in November 1916. One of their sons, William, returned home minus one leg, and as we know, he lived until he was 76 years old. But they probably went to their graves never knowing what had happened to Thomas Cotton, killed in action in Iraq 18 months after the fighting had finished on the Western Front. It was nearly 9 years later, in March of 1929, that the Basra Memorial was unveiled, and there are over 40,000 soldiers that are remembered on the Basra Memorial that have no known grave, including those 134 men, including Thomas, that died at the hands of the Iraqis in July of 1920. About 7 miles behind the famous city of Ypres, there is a massive cemetery that, when I do Terry's tours to the Ypres salient, is usually our first port of call. And it's called Lichtenhoek Military Cemetery. It is now, and it was during World War One, an enormous place. And I read recently that a young boy visited Lichtenhoek some years ago with his mother. And as he stood there, staring at the sea of headstones, he turned to his mum, who was holding his hand, and he said to her, "Mummy, something terrible happened here." And that young lad wasn't wrong, because this was the site of several enormous casualty clearing stations during the First World War. The whole site covered 125 acres, and it was placed here because it was far enough away from the front line to avoid most of the heavy German guns, and it was also near a railway station known as Remy Siding. And over time, the Royal Army Medical Corps set up incredible facilities in this place. There was over 4,000 beds. It was a real village with streets and flower beds, and they even had electricity installed. They held concerts and played football matches. Casualties were assessed and treated here and even operated on. They had operating facilities here before being transferred, if they survive, back to the base hospitals on the coast. Now, over the course of the time that Lichtenhoek was a medical facility, tens of thousands of soldiers would have passed through here. And as we know, the vast majority of them would have survived and they would have continued their onward journey to the base hospitals and then back to the UK, or been patched up and returned to their unit. But of course, as we know, not everybody could be saved. And because this was such a large facility, we now see in this silent city over 10,000 graves. As with all of the Commonwealth War Graves Commission cemeteries, it is an absolutely beautiful location as the last resting place for these men. And in Northampton, there's a terraced house in a road called St Leonard's Road in a working class part of town. And there lived a lady called Matilda Cowell. Now, she was widowed. Her husband had died some years before, leaving her with six sons. Four of them were to die in the Great War, all in 1918, just within 10 months of each other. And two of them are buried here at Lishenhook, not next to each other, but within about 50 yards. Percy Cowell, he was a machine gunner with the 59th Company, the Machine Gun Corps, and he was formerly with the Royal Lancashire Regiment before he was transferred to the Machine Gun Corps, and he died of his wounds on Saturday the 9th of February here at Lishenhook, and he was 26 years old. Matilda, she had the privilege to choose the words for his headstone, the personal inscription, and these are the words that she chose. "Although the sea and death divide, fond memories ever clings, Mother." Just 2 months later, Percy's brother, Frank, also died of wounds here at Lishenhook on the 14th of April 1918, and he's buried about three rows away from Percy. He was a sapper in the Royal Engineers, and once again, it was Matilda that chose those very emotional words for his headstone. This is what she wrote about Frank. "Not dead to those who loved him, not lost, but gone before, Mother." Frank was 21 years old. So 6 months went by in 1918, and no doubt Matilda was comforted by her friends and other relatives back home in Northampton, but she must still have been worrying about her two remaining sons that were fighting in the war. There was Thomas, and there was also George. George was serving with the 2nd Battalion of the Northamptonshire Regiment initially, and then he transferred to the Suffolk Regiment, and he was killed in action on the 23rd of October 1918, just what, 3 weeks or so, 2.5 weeks, 3 weeks before the armistice was signed. He was 19 and he was buried in a cemetery in France, not far from the Belgian border where he fell. And George was 19 years old, just 19 years old. So no doubt he was conscripted. I don't know for certain, but I'm sure at that age, at that stage of the war, he'd have been one of the conscripts. So now, as we come to the end of the war, towards the end of the war, poor Matilda has lost three of her sons. Now, at that time, as I said earlier in this podcast, the flu pandemic was sweeping across Europe, and the fourth son, Thomas, was to be a victim of the flu epidemic just a week after his brother George had died. He died on the 30th of October 1918 at a hospital in Dorset in the UK, and he's buried here in Northampton in the Toaster Road Cemetery. So there we have it. There's Matilda. She's lost her husband before the war. Four of her sons had died. Three of them, she probably never got to see their graves, they were too far away. I visited two of them, the two lads that are in Lishenhook, last year, and every time I go to Lishenhook, I'll go and place a cross at their graves and do what Matilda couldn't do. And the last one that died, the one that died of flu, Thomas, he's buried just, what, a 10-minute walk away from where Matilda lived, so she would have been able to attend his funeral and go and say her respects to him, and no doubt think of the three other boys that she lost during the Great War. During World War One, over 70 million pairs of boots were manufactured in the United Kingdom, not just for the British Army, but for our allies in the Italian Army, the French Army, and ironically now the Russian Army. Now, well over half of those 70 million pairs of boots were manufactured here where I live in Northamptonshire. And one of the hundreds of boot and shoe factories that was charged with producing these boots is still running today. It's an online company now, but it's called Crockett and Jones. that had been established in 1879 by two brothers-in-law, James Crockett and Charles Jones, and they both sent between them three sons off to serve in the Great War. Unfortunately, only one of them was to return. Percy Jones, he returned to Crockett and Jones Shoe Factory, and within 4 years of returning, he was to become a partner. And in 1924, it was a year of great pride for all of the company, because Crockett and Jones was honoured with a visit from the future King George VI, who paid great attention to the shoemaking process during the tour of the factory. And one of the reasons why royalty wanted to visit Crockett and Jones was because of the efforts that they'd made during the Great War. Over 600,000 pairs of boots were turned out from this factory during the war, and therefore by the end of the war they produced over 2 million pairs of boots for the Allies. It was the other partner, Mr. J.H.C. Crockett, that was to lose his two sons in the Great War, one killed in action and one who was a victim once again of the flu pandemic in 1918. So let's start off with Lawrence Crockett. He was a dentist by trade. He wasn't working in the family business. He was working as a dentist. And when war broke out, he joined the Royal Army Medical Corps. And off he went to France and to the Western Front. And he wrote a letter back to his father, which gives us an incredible impression of what it was like to be on the Western Front in those first year of the war. And this is what his letter said, I quote, "The noise of the guns was getting louder and louder as we marched, and after a short time we heard guns fired behind us, and we realised we were within the fighting area and felt somewhat unhappy about it," he says. "And yet we'd seen nothing of any opposition shells. Men were mending the road, cars were passing, football and cards were being played by men off duty. And we shared the obvious indifference of everybody around, and we marched on cheerfully. For a short time, they rested in a farmhouse. Shells were bursting around them, but being inside walls gave them a false sense of security. After a time, we were marched down again towards the trenches, ever exposed over flat land. A Jack Johnson, which is a German shell, burst about 75 yards away from another sergeant and myself. That did not make us feel very happy, but I do not think I was really frightened. I can imagine fear coming had any been shot down. The party got inside the trench and we made it as safe as possible. Their work of carrying in the wounded did not begin until after dark. When dark arrived, rifle fire and cannonade fire increased enormously, and our work was mostly in the open and carried out under fire. Our men behaved wonderfully, considering it was their first time under fire. Some of them penetrated up to our foremost trenches. They had to drop down in the mud every few minutes, for the Germans sent up star shells, which made everything standing up painfully obvious. Some of the wounded had been out there for 3 or 4 days without attention, and they were in a very sorry state." Now, after that time on the Western Front, Lawrence was sent out to Malta, where he was involved in the treating of the wounded that were coming back from the Gallipoli campaign and also the Middle East campaign. But in October 1918, he contracted the flu bug, and he came back to the UK, and he was sent to a hospital at Mundersley on the North Norfolk coast. But unfortunately, he died in October of 1918, and he was brought back to Northampton. And he was buried in the local church, Hampton Park Churchyard, in the family plot. His family made the decision not to have a Commonwealth War Graves Commission headstone, and his details are still recorded on the website, but they have a private memorial, not just remembering him, but remembering other members of the family, including his brother, Lieutenant Clifton Crockett. Now, Clifton had been commissioned into the Royal Warwickshire Regiment, and he was killed near the village of Poisier in August of 1916, and he's buried in the Poisier Cemetery, close to where he was killed. And what happened was his commanding officer wrote a letter back to his parents, which was published in the local newspaper, and it gives us some information about what happened to young Clifton. And he says, "It is with feelings of the deepest regret and profound sympathy that I have to inform you that your son, Lieutenant Crockett, was killed in action on Friday the 18th. He was hit in the head at the commencement of the attack and was found dead within 30 minutes. In writing to you on behalf of the battalion who mourn his loss, I wish to express my own personal sorrow. We owe your son a debt of gratitude which he can never repay. He rendered to this battalion services of incredible value, and it is the most difficult to replace all the officers we have lost. He was employed as an intelligence officer and was in charge of the battalion's snipers. He had a peculiar gift of orientation, was full of courage and resource, and helpful to the last degree. He never spared himself, and among other achievements was instrumental in effecting the capture of the machine gun of an enemy aeroplane which fell in front of our lines. He went out time after time to obtain information and was always possessed the priceless quality of being reliable. He was only with us a month, but in that short time he made his mark and definitely established himself in a position of trust. Although he was only attached to this battalion for a short time, so long as he was with us, he was one of us, and I hope and believe that he felt at home and happy with us. We feel about him as we do about all the officers who attached to us from other units, just the same as he belonged to this regiment from the very beginning. The battalion has lost one of its very best officers and one of its best comrades. He fell quite close to the German parapet and died as he had lived, doing his duty, and that right gallantly. I entertain for feelings of the very highest regard for him, as well as of his personal affection. These feelings are shared by us all. He was buried where he fell, and a cross put up in his memory. Just the rough wooden cross that trench warfare admits of. I earnestly hope that the pride which you are justifiably entitled to feel will be of real comfort to you in your bereavement. He made the supreme sacrifice, which we hope and believe will not have been in vain. Come what may, we shall hold his memory in admiration and affection, such as will never be effaced. I cannot tell you how I wish that he could have been spared to you and to us. Yours sincerely, Frederick Danielson, Lieutenant Colonel." In his memory, his parents made a substantial contribution, a voluntary contribution, to the Northampton General Hospital of £1,000, which was obviously a lot of money in those days. The General Hospital, part of it had been turned over to the military and was being used to treat casualties coming back from the Western Front. And they felt that would be a lasting legacy of Clifton. And at this stage, of course, they didn't know that the other boy, Lawrence, would die 2 years later. Now, two other lads, who I will describe as larrikins, Victor and George Corcoran, both returned to Northampton after the war, but they got themselves in a number of scrapes, not just during the war, but afterwards. Victor and George, they were called, typical Northampton lads, and like many others in the town, they worked in the boot and shoe industry. They came from a working class family, and they lived in a place called St James. When war broke out in 1914, they both joined the 1st Battalion of the Northamptonshire Regiment. George had previously served with this battalion, but he'd been discharged in 1910, and when I looked at his service record, there's a number of charges on there for drinking offences, which would crop up again as time went on. But that wasn't unusual. You know, a lot of these soldiers, and they still are, hard drinking lads who would sometimes get themselves in trouble for swearing or for being late and that sort of thing, being untidy on parade. Oh yes, George had got a few of those on his record before he was discharged in 1910. So off they went with the 1st Battalion. You know, they were obviously reservists and called up. And the 1st Battalion arrived in France on the 13th of August 1914, just in time for the Battle of Mons and the retreat that took place, the famous retreat, all the way back to the Marne in the summer and early autumn of 1914. And at some stage during this retreat, George was wounded, and he wrote a dramatic letter home to his parents explaining how he'd been wounded. And what I'm going to do now is read to you that letter that he wrote. He said that he'd been wounded in the left leg, and he crawled into a barn where he'd been for 3 days as he lay unconscious. And he said in his letter, "There were all stray bullets that killed and wounded us. We killed hundreds of them and captured thousands of the dogs. I will have another cut at them when I am better. It is their artillery that does the damage, but ours soon wiped them out. There is only about 400 left of our regiment, and that number must be accepted with the utmost reserve. In any case, we seem to have had very few casualties. I saw Joe Corcoran. I fought at Mons and every other battle, and I never thought there was a bullet for me after that." Now, George's brother Victor was badly wounded during the Battle of Loos in September 1915, one of many good Northampton lads that fell on that September morning. His wound was so bad that his leg was amputated, and that was the end of his war. He was discharged from the army. Now, as George recovered from his wounds, he found himself in bother with the army three times. On one occasion, he was confined to barracks for 14 days, and the charge sheet says, "not putting out lights when ordered." A bit harsh, you might think, but the second part of the same charge reads, "making an improper remark to the NCO." I wonder what that was. George returned to the front and was wounded twice more. When he was at home recovering from a severe arm injury, he married Laura at St James's Church in Northampton. And then in August of 1918, George joins the 6th Northants, and they took part in the crossing of the River Ank during the 100-day offensive. He was wounded in the thigh so badly that, just like his brother, his leg had to be amputated. George was treated at a military hospital in Richmond Park in Surrey, but his scrapes with the discipline of the army was not over, and his record shows that he was fined yet again 9 days' pay for being absent for 9 days in January of 1990. So both brothers returned to St James's missing a leg. But their exploits didn't end there, not by a long way. Victor lodged with his brother and their wife. However, they must have fallen out, as he ended up in court for trying to set fire to his brother's property. And then on another occasion, the local paper tells us that Victor was fined £10 for threatening George and Laura with a poker. And as for George, he used his walking stick to hit a Mr. Edwards over the head after an argument in their local pub called the Florence Nightingale in 1924. He claimed in court it was an accident. And what I'll do is I'll read an account of the incident that I found in the local paper. The newspaper reports, "George Corcoran, 39, of Devonshire Street, shoe operative, was charged with inflicting grievous bodily harm upon William Mark Edwards, also a shoe operative, also of Devonshire Street, on Saturday night by striking him on the head with a stick. The prisoner was further charged with committing a common assault. Edwards, whose head was bandaged, gave evidence that about 9:15 he called in the Florence Nightingale for a drink in the bar. About 9:40 he went to the singing room to see his wife. Corcoran's wife, who was there, insisted on his wife dancing with her, but the witness objected. A quarrel arose, and Corcoran hit him across the head with a stick as he went out. That was the only blow struck. The defendant said he did not think Edwards was so near to him as he was when he struck. It was not an intentional blow. The bench dismissed the charge of grievous bodily harm, and in answer to the common assault charge, the prisoner said he had nothing to add to the complainant's story. He was a cripple and always carried a stick. The defendant was found guilty and fined £1. So there we've got two brothers, the Corcoran brothers, that have both tragically lost a leg on the Western Front, but they've come home and it's not dampened their spirits at all. It's not stopped them being aggressive. They've obviously fallen out. One of them has tried to hit the other with a poker. And then George, not long after, has gone down the pub using a walking stick to prop himself up. And then whacked a bloke round the head because he thought he was dancing with his wife or singing with his wife. I tried to find the Florence Nightingale pub at Devonshire Street, but not surprisingly, the council pulled it down many years ago and replaced it with a block of flats. Now, next week, I shall be returning with Terry's Tours to the Western Front to do my first guided tour of the year. And who am I taking but Victor and George's great nephew? And we'll be walking in the footsteps of where George, with the 6th Northants, crossed the River Ank in August of 1918. And it was somewhere in that area that George So there we go. That's podcast number two done. Brothers in Arms, I've called it. And you can see why, because I've told just a few stories of siblings, some who didn't come home and some who did. To be honest, as I've told these stories today, it's made me feel very emotional when I think about some of these lads and what happened to their parents. How did they deal with their grief and not knowing, in some cases, what had happened to their boys? It has made me feel very emotional. Did the parents ever get a chance to visit their graves? Obviously, the guy out in Basra, absolutely no chance, and he didn't have a grave to go and see anyway. Did they ever have closure? I very much doubt it. And the reason why I wanted to talk about these, and they're all in Northampton where I live, is that Northampton is not unique. Wherever you live in the UK, within a short distance of your home, you'll be able to find stories as well if you go and investigate. If you go and start on the local war memorial, use the Commonwealth War Graves Commission website, you're soon going to be able to find stories that are similar to the ones that I've told in this podcast. So all it remains for me to do is to say thank you very much for tuning in to this podcast, Tales from the Battlefields. There'll be another one along probably next week. Haven't decided what yet, but I'll try and think of something. And I wanted to leave by reading just a few lines of the famous poem by Siegfried Sassoon that he called Aftermath. And it was played or read by the actor Charles Dance at Teepvale at the centenary commemorations in 2016, the centenary of the Battle of the Somme, and I was fortunate to be in the audience. Towards the end of the ceremony, it started to rain, and Charles Dance appeared on the platform underneath the Teepvale Memorial, and he read the poem Aftermath. And I'll just read to you just one paragraph of that poem. Do you remember the hour of din before the attack, and the anger, the blind compassion that seized and shook you then, as you peered at the doomed and haggard faces of your men? Do you remember the stretcher cases lurching back with dying eyes and lolling heads? Those ashen grey masks of the lads who once were keen and kind and gay. Have you forgotten yet? Look up and swear by the green of the spring that you will never forget. And by listening to this podcast and by telling the stories and learning about these men, we're doing exactly what Siegfried Sassoon said in those last two words of that famous poem. Look up and swear by the green of the spring that you will never forget. And by listening to Tales from the Battlefields, we are ensuring that these men are never, ever forgotten.